This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. There was speculation this week that President Bush might use Wednesday's anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight to announce a new goal in space, that being returning to the moon. Well, it didn't happen. Word is he's considering it for the State of the Union address. But we wonder, could it sound something like this?
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone.
Of course, that was President John F. Kennedy in a speech at Rice University in 1962, stating his policy about going to the moon and the challenge about doing it and not shirking from that challenge, saying it's a tough road to hoe, but we'll do it. The White House is reportedly discussing with NASA just how bold a statement this president is willing to make. Financial considerations and not a race with the Soviets are high on the list. But the lack of an official announcement hasn't stopped all kinds of folks from weighing in with opinions on trips to the moon or Mars or advanced construction projects in space. So why don't you weigh in? What do you think? Do you agree with Arthur C. Clarke that the most surprising thing about going to the moon is that we could go there and never go back? Do you think that perhaps the reason we haven't returned to the moon is because we depend too much on the government to pay for it? Perhaps if we opened up space travel to private enterprise, we might get there faster. After all, it was private industry that developed the airplane and created the airline industry. Just 30 years after Kitty Hawk, airliners were offering transcontinental travel, competing for passengers. Now, a full four decades after the first man in space, why hasn't the same thing happened to space flight? Why is it taking so long to develop consumer and business space travel? Could it be there is no real profit incentive for private industry? After all, who are you going to visit on the moon? Would a presidential challenge like the one Kennedy made change that? Create perhaps a tourist industry, mining the moon, astronomy? What are the obstacles in the way? Well, if you'd like to join in that conversation, give us a call. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Sally Ride is a woman of many hats. She's, of course, the first American woman in space, a former astronaut, a professor of physics at the University of California at San Diego, the founder and CEO of Imaginary Lines, Inc. That's a company promoting young women's interests in science, math, and technology. She's also an author, a new book called Exploring Our Solar System, published by Crown Books for young readers. And Dr. Ride joins us from UCSD campus. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Andrew Chaikin is a science journalist and author of many books, including A Man on the Moon, and he joins us by phone from Vermont. Welcome back, Andy.
Hello, Ira. Greetings from snowy Vermont.
Yeah, I'll bet. And also with us is Brian Chase. He's the executive director of the National Space Society based in Washington, and he joins us from Washington in our NPR studios there. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira.
Let me ask all of you. First, let me ask you, Andy, this rumored announcement, do you think that it's going to really come sometime soon?
Yeah. In fact, I kind of have it from the horse's mouth, not to use an untoward image for our NASA administrator, who is a very impressive guy. But I was at a space policy workshop recently in Pasadena that Sean O'Keefe convened, and the word is that we are definitely going to have something from the White House by the first week of February at the latest. My sense is, and I don't have this, you know, none of us have definitive information on this, that the president is waiting, he is currently weighing his options, and that he is also waiting for one or both of the upcoming Mars landings, the robotic landings, to be successful. I can also say that the new announcement will be unambiguous. It will be something new, very new in direction, and my sense is that it will not be about a particular place. It won't be a call to send humans back to the moon by such and such a date or get to Mars. Rather, It is aimed at establishing a capability for NASA to do a whole lot of things with both humans and robots in space.
That sounds ambiguous, though. You said it's not
going
to be ambiguous.
I'm trying to keep it short. There's a lot more where that came from.
I've got another 45 minutes.
Well, you know, we've got some time here. But but my sense is that it is going to be a plan that they're going to try to accomplish humans to Mars and along the way build giant telescopic arrays in deep space, potentially send humans back to the moon, in part for scientific research, but also partly as a kind of an outward bound school for the potential Mars voyagers. This is a kind of a training ground on the moon, because you can actually get real world experience, so to speak, in living on another planet. And a host of robotic precursor missions and new technologies that would pave the way for the human missions. And the really surprising thing about all this, or I guess the really new thing about it, is that they're going to try and do this at currently projected funding levels. Now, I know that part of this is going to have to be finishing the space station and then allowing a lot of the funding that's currently going into the construction of the space station to become available for other things. But my sense is that they're not pinning this on some major new initiative in terms of lots of extra money.
Hmm. They can do all of that with this current budget as
well. I'm not saying they can, and matter of fact, I think Sally has made some comments about that recently. I'm not sure that you can do it with the current budget, but I think their goal is to kind of buy it by the yard, in the sense of do as much as they can with the money they get, but keep making progress towards a set of common goals for all parts of NASA. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that was addressed, I think, in Sally's report with the Columbia board was that NASA needs to revamp its internal culture, and part of that is to have all the different parts and pieces of NASA moving in a common direction. And I should say also that Sean O'Keefe impressed me as somebody who is very, very aware of the reality of the situation that NASA's in. Very, very tenuous credibility right now, needs to work very hard to restore that credibility by actually achieving things, and really is not interested in fantasy. He's really interested in making something happen that's actually doable in the real world.
Sally Ride, what's your reaction to this?
Well, I really hope that Andy's right and that we do hear an unambiguous announcement within the next month or two. I think it would be a great thing for the space program. And I have to say that, you know, when you stop to think that we haven't been back to the moon in over 30 years, it's really just kind of remarkable. And I suspect that if you had asked any of us 30 years ago whether it would take 30 years to get back to the moon, we all would have said, well, that's ridiculous. Of course, we'll not only be back to the moon, but probably be on Mars by then. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are a lot of us out there who are really hoping that the space program does get a good, clear, unambiguous, overarching goal that'll keep us focused and keep us moving forward.
Brian,
but, you know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sally. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was just going to say that the space program really took a body blow with the Columbia tragedy earlier this year, and it has one of the good things that has come out of it is that it's stimulated and brought to the front a discussion that was already going on about the future of the space program and what the goals of the space program should be. And it's brought more urgency to the discussion of the space transportation that we should have, what should replace the space shuttle, but maybe more importantly, what should the goal of our space transportation be? It should be taking us somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Brian Chase, how do you react to all of this possibilities here? What are its strengths and shortcomings as you see it?
Well, I think that all three of us agree that that it would be very welcome for NASA and our nation's overall human space exploration efforts to have a unified vision. And I think what's going to be different about this announcement that we're all hoping is going to be coming is that it's not going to be an Apollo-type announcement. This is not going to be a situation where we apply a massive amount of money and a massive amount of political resources and national treasure into a single effort to go to a single place. I think what Sean O'Keefe has wanted to lay out in this process, and indeed was laying out prior to the loss of Columbia, was an evolutionary roadmap to look at a plan and an approach that would enable us to explore the entire solar system rather than trying to restrict us to a single destination and pouring all of our resources into a single vehicle and a single program. And so while I understand your comment that sounds a little bit ambiguous, I think what you're going to see in the roadmap is that it's an evolutionary step saying perhaps the moon is first as a testing ground, and then there's other steps along the way, ultimately leading to an expedition to Mars. But it's the technology required to build that over time. It's not going to be a situation where we have a timetable that says we have to do this within 10 years. And I think that's going to be the big difference. You know, in a lot of ways, the Apollo program spoiled us. It spoiled those of us who support space exploration because we thought that this is the way that every program has to be done. We have to throw a lot of money into it. It has to be entirely government-led. And what we've learned over the years, and I think we're finally coming to the point that we understand the problem, is that it's not the way that it really is. And I think in a lot of ways we're getting back on track to a more evolutionary program that we left 30 years ago.
Do you think that any such program that is this wide-ranging would have to have a public-private partnership where you would have some of the private sector get in on this and start creating a civilian space effort as we had the civilian airplane effort following the Wright brothers?
Absolutely. I think one of the critical parts of this initiative has to be the free market forces and the private sector. There's a lot of innovative companies and a lot of innovative ideas here in the U.S. and internationally. We see that at work in every sector of the economy, and we have to ensure that we capture that spirit of innovation and that spirit of free enterprise in space exploration.
We had Congressman Sherrod Bollard, who's the head of the House Science Committee, which oversees the NASA budget, on a few months ago talking about where do we go in space. And he said, listen, you know, there's no money coming out of this Congress, at least my committee, unless NASA comes up with an overall plan, a vision, something, you know, and instead of just piecemeal build a rocket, build a this, do that kind of thing. From what I'm hearing today, they are working in that direction, it sounds like.
Ira, can I
yes, Andy.
Say something about that also, which is that it's very clear in the discussions that I've been hearing that not only is it a vision, but it is a vision in the name of scientific discovery. That this program, as much as possible, is going to be driven by science. And I think that that is being articulated more clearly than we ever have in the past. As you know, as we all know, Apollo was not science-driven, even though we went to the moon and did some fantastic science and made some amazing discoveries. We went to the moon to beat the Russians. Similarly, the space shuttle was built for a whole slew of purposes and missions, and the International Space Station, one of the problems with it is that the mission was never really narrowed down to a specific mission. I think O'Keefe is very anxious to change that. I think that he and the other leaders at NASA understand that the public is excited about science, excited about discoveries like those with the Hubble telescope, and so that's one of the most important aspects.
Now, the science missions have been very successful at NASA, and JPL have carried out. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about this and take your phone calls. We're talking with Sally Ride, Andrew Chaikin, and Brian Chase about the future of space travel with people involved in this one outside of our Earth systems to the moon, possibly to Mars. What do you think we should do? We'll take your calls and talk lots more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about exploring, we'll say the moon, Mars, solar system, the future of space and American policy in space with my guests, Sally Ride, former astronaut, author of Exploring Our Solar System, and founder and CEO of Imaginary Lines Incorporated, Andrew Chaikin, science journalist, author of several books, including A Man on the Moon, Brian Chase, the executive director of the National Space Society. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the lines. Dave in Philadelphia. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
First off the bat, I just want to thank Mr. Chaikin for The Man on the Moon. It's one of my favorite books, and I take it out and read it to my children as long as they let me. For those of us who grew up in the space age, and who have continued our love of science and space, I think we need to be reminded that there's a whole generation or so out there who may not value what happened on the moon as much as we do. I had the opportunity to tour the country in the course of my job and talk to high school students, and I would ask them about, you know, Neil Armstrong and walking on the moon, and upwards of a third of them would say that they, one, either didn't believe it happened or that it wasn't a significant event as we all feel it was. With that as an obstacle, I think we have an education challenge in teaching people how important it is for us to go on further in space.
Why do they think it didn't happen? They think it's a hoax? Their parents are lying to them? Or?
Well, yeah, there's a very popular website you can go to and download a little video that shows Neil Armstrong bounding down the ladder, and at the last minute you see a lighting truss swing in the background and a couple of stagehands pop out from behind the set and reset him. I had one student come up to me and show me how the photographs of famous photograph of Buzz Aldrin on the moon was faked, because you could see disjointed sections of the photograph. And as I explained to him that it was a composite photograph made up of separate photographs, he refused to believe it.
Hmm. Sally Wright, any reaction?
Well, I've heard a lot of that too, and I think that those of us who grew up at the time don't think much of the hoax idea, and any of the things that people have brought out actually have pretty easy explanations for them. So, you know, having talked to both Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, I'm pretty well convinced that they were actually there.
Hmm. Yeah, I will
say though that. That I've run into the same thing in talking to kids growing up. I find that there are a lot of them who don't know who Neil Armstrong was. They don't know very much about the Apollo program, and you know, you might take that as bad news for the future of the space program. But the other side of that is that they remain very, very interested in space. They're, you know, they're just fascinated by, you know, what astronauts feel when they're weightless, whether there's life on Mars, how long it takes to get to Pluto. I mean, the kids growing up today still have a basic, almost gut level fascination with space and the space program, whether they know the history of the space program or not.
Andrew, did you want to jump in there?
I didn't mean to interrupt Sally. I just was going to say Neil Armstrong had a great quote about the whole moon hoax theory, which is that it would have been harder to fake it than to do it. And I do think that, and I'm sure Sally has paid a lot of effort to this in her work, but, you know, we do have a challenge ahead of us in this country. I think one of the problems with any kind of long-range plan for NASA is that space exploration is really about the long-term future of humanity, whether you're talking about stimulating the economy, new discoveries, gaining new knowledge, or even protecting the planet from the eventual threat of an asteroid impact. And yet, our culture is obsessed with the short term and with celebrity and with a lot of other things that kind of take us away from the real stuff that matters, I think. Mm. And so, you know, I think part of the problem is in a country where we're obsessed with the next electoral cycle, where NASA's budget cycle is measured in years, if not 1 year, to try and create any kind of long-term plan is a real challenge, and to try and keep a sustained sense of progress is crucial.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Brian, as executive director of the National Space Society, can you share with us what you think would any future space effort, should the basic ingredients that your organization thinks should include?
Well, one of the basic ingredients is actually something that Andrew just mentioned, which is that space exploration is about more than just scientific discovery or any of the benefits that it can accrue immediately in our society here on Earth. It really is about the future of humanity and the future of civilization. If you look at throughout history, societies that expand their frontiers and explore their frontiers and ultimately settle their frontiers are those societies that prosper and innovate and move forward. those that don't, those that choose to essentially stagnate, are the ones that are left to the footnotes in the history books. So that's really the key ingredient, is we have to understand this is a very, very big picture initiative we're undertaking. Although the immediate benefit that we may find is the scientific return and economic development, ultimately this is about a much greater thing for our society and our civilization. So that's a crucial ingredient. And the number two ingredient really is the ability to infuse the free enterprise into the system and make sure we can take advantage of that as we move forward. This is, should not just be a government initiative. We need to tap into the innovative private sector wherever possible.
It would seem to me that creating and you mentioned this as one of the goals of the National Space Society, is to create a permanent lunar base. And Andrew talked about it as possibly a goal the president may have in mind for training astronauts or people as a jumping-off point. It seems to me a lunar base you could do lots of things with, from the astronomy, radio telescope astronomy, because you have all the signal noise behind you in the Earth, especially if you did it on the dark side of the moon. Mining skills, things like that. Wouldn't that be one of the keystones of any policy, do you think?
I think that it is. The establishment of a lunar facility, and in particular a permanent lunar facility, offers a tremendous capability for the United States and any partners we may have in that initiative. The moon is a very stable platform, and in essence you can think of it as a platform, as a space station for us to conduct operations from. To launch missions further than the moon and into deep space, human missions to Mars, whatever the case may be, is much less expensive from the moon if you actually conduct these operations from the lunar surface, because it is much easier to escape the very small gravity that the moon possesses versus the Earth. So it does offer a tremendous possibility, both on the exploration side as well as a huge possibility for economic development.
What about other countries? You know, we've heard recently that China now is becoming, has entered the space partnership of putting people in space, and they have expressed their desire to go to the moon, possibly Mars. Andrew, should we partner with them? Should we not? Are we going to do this in a typical only America sort of thing when we talk about going into a space venture this way?
Well, I certainly hope not. And I know that when the Chinese launched their first astronaut several weeks ago, leading up to that and at that time, there was a whole bunch of speculation about whether or not this might spur some kind of renewed competition that might, give a jump start to our program. And I think that kind of thinking is really outdated, and we can't go back to 1961. It's not the Cold War anymore. And I certainly hope that if we put humans on the moon and on Mars, that we do it internationally. One of the interesting things that I've heard said about the Chinese program is that they really were not aiming at us. They were not trying to impress us. They were trying to impress many of the other countries in the world that are less of an economic superpower than us. The fact that China has now arrived in the big leagues, and space exploration really does give a country a level of international prestige. And the other comment that I thought was fascinating was that just as in this country, a space program helped inspire the current generation of innovators, of engineers and scientists who help drive our economy, that part of the benefits of China's space program inside China may be to create a similar boom in students who go on to become engineers and scientists and help turn China into an economic powerhouse. Having said all that, I do agree that it would be very desirable to work out our differences, just as we're trying to do with the Russians in the space station program, and go to the moon internationally, go to Mars internationally.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Mark in Panama City, Florida. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Just had a couple comments. First is, as was hit on early in the program, there's very little appeal to private investments because there's, I think there's no perceived immediate return. Like you said, the short term is not very desirable for them. The second comment, more the point, is also, as Dr. Ride and the other commentator hit on, is that there isn't as much, to me, appeal to the masses, the public. They, You know, there's more focus on the celebrity of things, and the public is, in general, very blasé about the space program. So, and I know for the only reasons that I know about some things that are going on is just various websites I check, but to me it seems like there could be a little bit more of a PR effort to get the word out and maybe get more people interested.
Well, that's an interesting point because, you know, it was Bush the Elder, as you know, this president's father, who at one point said, you know, we should reinvigorate the man in space program and go to Mars. And everybody said, what a great idea, and nothing happened.
Well, actually, Sean O'Keefe told us something very interesting about that. He, even before Columbia, the Columbia tragedy, he met with Bush Sr., and he thought it would be, he wanted to meet with Bush Sr. and ask him what happened. Why did his space proposal go under so quickly? And what he thought would be a short discussion turned into a two-hour conversation. He said President Bush remembered every detail of the process, and it all boiled down to this. He said, I was set up. We all got set up. And the problem was that somebody convinced the White House that you could go back to 1961, and all you needed was a presidential announcement, and everything else would fall into place. Well, we saw very rapidly after that 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 was not true. And I think the difference now is that everybody understands it's going to take more than a presidential announcement. It's going to take having the plan in place with capabilities that are already available to start the plan in motion. It means not depending on a huge increase in the NASA budget. And by the way, one of the things that has been stressed is that this plan is not going to be set in stone when it's announced. It's going to be an evolving plan. And if along the way they find out new ways of doing things that they didn't know about, well, then they're going to turn toward those things. So I think it's a very, very different time than when Bush Sr. made his announcement. Having said that, I'm not sure that the public is apathetic about space, and I think one of the most important things is to quantify the level of public interest so that whenever these conversations happen, we can point to some real numbers.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I guess if and when we hear this announcement, there will there actually be step one, step two, step three, or some sort of flow chart that will get us to different places, or are they just going to be, oh, we should have a goal of doing this and doing that?
Well, I don't know the answer, but my sense is that people at NASA are preparing very hard to be ready when the White House does make the announcement, whatever that turns out to be. And NASA has never had any shortage of flowcharts and plans, and I think that in this case they will be ready with lots of supporting material to flesh that out.
We're talking about space travel this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, who was ready to say something there?
Ira, this is Brian.
Brian.
I was going to comment on that. I think that NASA has done a lot of thinking about what that roadmap should be. Even before this task force was convened and before Columbia was lost, NASA had established a new position, that of space architect, and they were looking at that overall overarching plan of where we need to go in space and looking at some very innovative new technology that needed to be developed in order for us to to meet the milestones in that roadmap. Even before the loss of Columbia, NASA was proposing restarting a lot of the nuclear power and propulsion research initiatives, which are so critical to deep space exploration. So I think that we will see an initial roadmap, but it will evolve over time. I wanted to comment quickly on the caller's remark that there's no return on space activities, and that is a major challenge right now because it is so expensive fundamentally to get to low Earth orbit, and that's really one of the biggest barriers we have is the cost of getting to low Earth orbit in terms of the free enterprise. So that's one of the reasons that it's so critical to continue government industry efforts to reduce the cost of getting to orbit. The second component to getting a good return on space activities is the government, both NASA and the Department of Defense in particular, have to be good customers of the private sector. That's a complaint that I've heard for years and years, and I've worked for NASA, I've worked for contractors and now on the outside, and I've also worked on Capitol Hill, and it's a continuous complaint that people don't see that there's a reliable customer base. They're not sure if they're going to have that business a year from now, and so therefore it's very difficult for them to invest the capital required in the very, very expensive components needed to, whether it's launch vehicles or whatever the case may be, to do that kind of work.
Sally Wright, does NASA have every kind of possible plan stuck in a drawer somewhere they can pull out and say, oh, this sounds like 35C? I've been thinking about this from someone who's been inside the black box there.
Well, you know, it's very true that over the past couple of decades, NASA has done a lot of thinking about just this sort of thing. What infrastructure would be required? What are the infrastructure options? What are the various things that need to be in place for any particular goal? And, you know, that's part of NASA's job, is to be ready with plans, or to be able to think through a particular option relatively quickly and put forward the pros and the cons and give an estimate of the feasibility of a projection. So, and I'm certain that a lot of that work has been going on within NASA, certainly over the past year. And as I said, you know, it is NASA's business to be doing that sort of thing.
Why not farm it out to different companies who say, you know, here's the specs of what we want to do, and send out bids like the government does, and then hire the company that can make it, the device or whatever you're trying to do, or come up with the plan?
Well, of course, NASA does a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
NASA does a lot of that. Examples range from the orbital space plane, where, you know, companies are asked to put forward their best ideas and try to develop their own plans and their own ideas. I think that's just something that NASA does on a routine basis. But they also have a lot of internal work going on to put together sort of the fundamental an understanding of the fundamental technologies, do some of the initial brainstorming so that they know what to ask industry to respond to.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break, come back and talk more with Sally Wright, Andrew Chaikin, and Brian Chase, and talk more with you. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Where do you think we should be going in space? Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note: Monday on Talk of the Nation, join host Neil Conan and retired General Wesley Clark. That's on next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this hour on Monday, we're talking this hour about national goals in space with my guest Sally Wright, former astronaut, CEO of Imaginary Lines and author of Exploring Our Solar System; Andrew Chaikin, science journalist and author of several books, including A Man on the Moon; Brian Chase, executive director of the National Space Society. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Tucson and Courtney. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I wanted to go back to your earlier discussion on kind of the younger person's perspective on space exploration. And I just, growing up, I always wanted to be an astronaut more than anything.
Are you a younger person?
Oh, well, I'm a college student, yeah. Uh-huh. Sorry, I didn't preface with that. And I think that with all this talk of the costs, and, you know, I know that it costs a lot just to put anything into space, but I think in terms of, you know, national morale and just the philosophic part of it, I think that as humans, it amazes me that we can even have this discussion and that there is the possibility. And I think that if we were to really explore what we can really do in space, that it would just mean so much just in my mind and I know in the minds of others in America and in the world. And I don't know.
Just baffled why we just discuss all the costs and benefits just to discover it, right? Just as the pure intellectual and scientific discovery value. Why do we have to justify it? Doesn't it say itself and scream itself to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just...
And does that turn you off that everybody's thinking about it in those terms?
It does. I mean, I know it might sound naive to some I just want people to know that I'm considering the cost, and I know that it might take away from other things, but I think it means so much more, not in numbers, but in just the morale and the feeling of knowing that we can do it.
Courtney, personally, let me tell you, it's a refreshing change to hear somebody say something that we should just do it because it's the right thing to do, and it's smart to do it, and it's a no-brainer to do it.
That's what I think.
Sally, do you agree with her?
You know, I think that's just great, because what Courtney's saying is this is what people do. You know, it is innate in who we are to push back frontiers, to explore, to have a a real desire to understand, to try to learn more about ourselves and our environment, in this case our solar system, our universe. People have been exploring for centuries and centuries and centuries, and they'll still be exploring centuries from now. You know, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm. So, Courtney, if the president said this in January in a State of the Union, do you think this is a good campaign year thing to talk about?
I think it is. I think that we've become focused on so many, I guess, to me, like, disheartening things and stuff that kind of makes me wonder at who we are as human beings and what people are capable of. And then, but then to put this on the table and say, well, look at what we can do in a positive light and look at what can come of it. I mean, we don't know really what will come of it. I mean, I just, I guess Sally had a good point when she said that if people had said 30 years later, we would still be at the same spot and not going to the moon anymore. I mean, I didn't grow up then, but I know that I would be surprised as well. Yeah.
That's what Arthur C. Clarke said, you know, when they asked him, how could we not go back?
Yeah, that's what I
mean, it's just like, yeah, I know. Okay. It wouldn't have anything to do that you live in Tucson, where all that space stuff goes on. All
yeah, it's kind of hard to escape sometimes, but it is fun to go back and think about when I was a kid and how much I wanted to be an astronaut, and I guess I just like the idea of there being that possibility, and if, you know, NASA doesn't explore it more, I fear that people won't have that job anymore, and that's something scary to me just as a kid inside, I guess.
Terrific. All right. Thanks for calling, Courtney.
Thank you for taking my call.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. What do you think, I'm going to ask my guests, what do you think the effect that the space station, the International Space Station, I think in most people's minds is a dud? I mean, it's a lot of scientists said we shouldn't have it. It's gotten into trouble with the shuttle problems. Now it's basically shut down for the most part, just being maintained. How do you sell another idea of going someplace else when, you know, people say, hey, look, at the space station, we're going to sink a lot more money into another project? Or should we just do away with the space station and just go on to the next thing, say, sometimes things don't work out. Let's just forget that and move on to the next step, maybe going to the moon.
I don't think you can just walk away from the space station, although I did hear a couple of people at the workshop say that we should just put it up on eBay. But, you know, I think the space station has been really frustrating for people who believe in space exploration because it has been kind of mired in bureaucracy, and it wasn't really designed with a very clear mission in mind, and it has gone way over budget. And, by the way, I still personally have not seen a clear explanation of how that happened, the $4.5 billion overrun, and that's one of the things that has strained NASA's credibility. However, we can salvage the situation. The space station could be used to do research that would enable people to go to Mars. And once we get it finished, as I say, there will be more funding available for these other things. And I think the main thing is for NASA to make it very clear that they are doing things differently now, that they're not making decisions that are designed to just preserve the size of a particular organization or a space enterprise, and that really they're going in with their eyes open to what the real world is.
But would they also admit, and I'll ask Sally this also, that maybe the way they do things is a little bit rigid? We when we talk about new space adventures, for example, setting a colony on the moon, lots of listeners will call in and say, you know, if NASA puts it together, it's going to be like an Erector set. It's going to be super solid, you know, transportation costs are going to be terrible because they're going to build this out of rigid steel, blah, blah, blah. There are other easier ways of doing it out of Kevlar, maybe taking, you know, like those the tank from the shuttle and you take it into space with you and you leave it on the moon or something like that, you know. We could do it much cheaper and much more imaginative if we just let people outside of NASA help design it. Sally, do you think they're open to any kind of new and innovative ideas like that?
I hope so, because it's essential to harness the imaginations of the people out there who've been thinking about this. You know, NASA doesn't have you know, the sole ownership of creative ideas for getting to space. And, you know, a lot of the thinking has been going on for years and years and years, and sometimes you get in a rut with your thinking, and sometimes you don't. You lose your creativity, you lose your imagination, and it's essential to have, you know, smart, creative, imaginative people from whatever walk of life and whatever age be able to have some input into the process and be able to have their ideas heard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ira, this is Sally's absolutely right about that. It's absolutely critical that we have that creative process at work. I think this is also a very good point to mention as you talk about the International Space Station, that it's not just NASA that is under the spotlight here. It's important for the White House and the President to provide the political capital needed to support an initiative, and it's also up to Congress to let ultimately NASA and whoever is tasked with completing the project let it do its job. If you look at the history of the space station program, it is rife with situations where Congress stepped in and actually made technical decisions that were devastating for the program in terms of causing even some of the cost overruns that we see today. So in partially in defense of NASA, to say that they're entirely to blame for what we see as a space station now is not entirely is not entirely fair, because the burden can be shared among all of the parts of the federal government. And in the last administration, unfortunately, NASA had what was virtually a gag order on looking at anything beyond the space station. And so there was a period of time where NASA couldn't even talk about what they wanted to do beyond the space station. They couldn't say that the space station was intended to be to look beyond low Earth orbit. So they had a lot of barriers put in their way in the process. Doesn't mean that there's not problems now that need to be addressed, this is a team effort, not only just in general between NASA and the private sector, but NASA has to have the support from Congress and the White House to do its job properly.
Let me see if I can get one more call in. Tia in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Tia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I just want to say that I'm all for harnessing, energy and imagination, but I have to defend, my younger generation and give a different perspective and try to make a connection between the short-sightedness that we've been talking about and, lack of interest in the space program. I think that it's difficult to ask people that, are college graduates and don't have jobs. And, in the economy the way it is, like, I feel personally like I'm living an example of Maslow's pyramid. I think when you're dealing with an economy that is the way it is, it's hard to ask people to be as far-sighted as we need them to be, to have the right kind of energy to get the space program going. And in terms of the economic developments that you were discussing earlier, I have to admit, I'm ignorant when it comes to economics, and my question is, are the economic developments that you're talking about, are those just, going to mean extra manufacturing jobs, for example, or, could you bridge that gap for me a little bit?
Mm-hmm. All right, let me get an answer. Let me remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. The spinoffs, the economic jobs, Andrew, you want to tackle that? What kind of jobs could be created here? Or,
well, I can try. I'm not very good at economics either, but I do have a gut level sense that the space program is one of the cutting edge things in our country that does drive new inventions, which creates jobs. As many people in the space program used to say, Alan Shepard once said, all the money that was spent on getting us to the moon was spent on Earth. So just the sheer expenditure is part of the economy. But
we also had a whole generation of children, me being one of them, that grew up and went to school
That's what I was going to say. I think the biggest thing about the space program is the inspirational value and the fact that everywhere I go, that I go and talk to school kids of all ages, they're absolutely captivated with the idea of exploring space, and it's one of the things that can stimulate them to learn science, to learn engineering, to learn technology, which is what our whole world is about now. To be competitive, you've got to go into those areas, and I think space is part of what inspires kids to do that.
And you'd have to create, if you're really serious, I don't know if the plan is not to spend any money, more money than we are now, then maybe there are not going to be that many jobs created if we're basically just sinking the same amount of money into NASA.
You have to look at this in terms of a long-term investment. I understand the difficulties that the caller expresses, and I'm very sympathetic, but I think it would be a tragedy if the current economic difficulties make us feel like we can't afford to invest in the long term. Space is about our long-term future, and I think it's critical.
Okay, Tia?
Yeah, no, I agree. Thanks very much for your comment. I also think education is a great long-term investment, and I wish I'd see more talk of that. But I really do appreciate it, and I wish you the best.
All right, thank you. Of course, there was a huge education outpouring in the 60s, late 50s and 60s, about, as Andrew was saying, training all these rocket engineers, or what we thought we were going to be, and resetting the priorities about math and science education in schools. Sally, any comment to her about the spinoffs or what we could expect if this comes to pass?
Well, actually, let me make a comment about education, because I think Andy started down this road. One of the really interesting values that the space program brings and space exploration brings is its fascination to kids growing up. And that does encourage them and can be used to encourage them to continue their education or to pay more attention to their education when they're in school. You know, kids who are really interested in space exploration might spend more time studying math, studying science, that are the building blocks that will enable them to build a foundation to take advantage of opportunities as they grow older that could be job opportunities. It basically lets them build the skills to be employable, useful citizens in the sort of technological age that we're in these days. So it really does have a role in education. In ways that you might not consider.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to cut it short this hour on this topic. And after the president, if and when he makes a statement, we'll come back and talk about what the initiative is that he's proposing. So we'll follow this up and maybe have some of our guests back to talk about it. Let me thank them all for joining us. Sally Wright, former astronaut, professor of University of California, San Diego, the founder and CEO of Imaginary Lines. Her latest book is Exploring Our Solar System, co-authored with Pam O'Shaughnessy. It's a great book if you're looking for something for kids for this holiday season and you still got that list open. This is a terrific book. Thank you for joining us, Sally.
Thank you.
Andrew Chaikin, science journalist and author of several books, including A Man on the Moon. The book speaks for itself. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Brian Chase, executive director of the National Space Society based in Washington. Thank you, Brian, for joining us this hour.